Hello, everyone. This is Frida Garcia, gender advisor and podcaster at the Inter-American Defense College. And you are listening to the IADC's Women, Peace, and Security Program. Across the globe, heads of state and government are prioritizing the advancement of the Women, Peace, and Security agenda. Addressing this on our podcast are two experts, Professors Brenda Opperman and Vanessa Brown, our hosts for this new program. In this series, our hosts will unlock the power of the WPS agenda, tying episodes to its four pillars: participation, protection, prevention, and relief and recovery. They'll invite guests with whom they'll delve into matters of strategic interest through a WPS lens, highlighting trailblazers and their advancements, but also the challenges, problems, and risks they face. Alongside their guests, Brenda and Vanessa will guide us through the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies out there for WPS operationalization and institutionalization, so that you, our listeners, can successfully implement WPS principles wherever you may be. On today's episode, I'm very excited to welcome for the first time our new hosts for this series, Professors Brenda Opperman and Vanessa Brown. And as we'll hear from our guests today, their professional journeys intersect with each other's at various points, albeit sometimes from different parts of the world and life chapters. Professor Brenda Opperman has extensive experience as a practitioner and an academic working on conflict, peace, security, and gender equality. As a senior advisor and subject matter expert, she has 30-plus years of experience, including more than 7 years in conflict-affected countries, specializing in women, peace and security, stability operations, organizational change, leadership, and traditional justice. She has extensive experience working in Africa, Central Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. She also has significant experience with interagency processes, civil-military relations, and bilateral and international collaboration. Brenda is currently an associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College and chief game changer at Game Changers 360. She holds a master's in international relations from Yale University and a Juris Doctor from Western New England University School of Law. Dr. Vanessa Brown holds a PhD in sociology from Carleton University. Her thesis investigates the integration of gender and cultural perspectives in professional military education and its relationship to organizational culture change. Dr. Brown joined the Canadian Forces College as a lecturer in 2015, teaching institutional policy studies for the Joint Command and Staff Program. She was recently appointed assistant professor in the Department of Defense Studies at the Canadian Forces College. Dr. Brown has assumed a variety of Department of National Defense research and advisory roles in recent years, including as an assistant professor with the Dallaire Center of Excellence for Peace and Security, as well as a gender advisor to the commander of the Canadian Defense Academy. Lastly, she was the chief instructor for our first Gender Integration and Perspectives elective course at the Inter-American Defense College in 2022. Later on the show, I'll ask them both to walk us through tackling taboo concepts in an academic setting. But now, over to our special guests. Hello, Brenda and Vanessa. Let me just jump right in and ask you to take me back to the beginning. Where did your interest in defense come from? And let's start with you, Vanessa.
Well, first and foremost, Frida, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today, and for having Brenda and I as your co-hosts moving forward. I think this is going to be a fantastic opportunity for us, but as well as your listeners. And I just really want to tell you how appreciative I am of this opportunity. So my story is, it goes way back. I started getting interested in defense because I grew up in a family that was very gendered, and the men typically went into the military and the women typically went into education. And so when I was 16, we had a presentation from the Canadian Armed Forces at my high school, and I was very interested. And I signed up to have a military member come to my house and explain the process of signing up for military service. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your view of my career trajectory, when the sergeant came to my house, in a very gendered way, my mom erupted into tears that I would have decided to join the military. And so this was a question for me in my identity growing up from a very young age about why can't I? Why this big emotional response to me joining the military from my mom? Yeah. And it became this this longstanding question for me that followed me in through education. So I did what I was supposed to do, I suppose, in a gendered way in my family. And I followed the education track for the women in my family. And here we are. I'm now working within the defense context. I'm a public servant, a civilian, and a professor at Canadian Forces College in the Canadian Armed Forces.
Wonderful. Now tell me, did you ever have that conversation with your mom and asked her?
Ever since?
Yeah.
We talk about it sometimes, as I say, you know, mom, my master's thesis, my PhD thesis were all about the military because I had this question about why. Mm-hmm. And she's very proud and has done a lot of self-reflection since. And we've reflected together on, you know, the gendered roles within the military establishment, what civilians think of the military and the gender roles within and where women fit. And certainly these conversations have evolved over time. And even in my over my career, they're still evolving. So it's wonderful to see now how thinking about the military in terms of its gendered nature is factored so deeply into how I got here in the first place.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it starts, you know, with the people we love, the people we're closest to, you know, to have these conversations and really dig deep into why we grew up thinking the way that we did and how we evolve and where it takes us, you know. So I'm really glad that you had that conversation. Now, Brenda, tell us, how did this begin for you?
Yes. Well, first, Frida, thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this phenomenal program that you've created. Yes, I think when I was in high school, I thought about joining the Army, and I spoke to my father, who had only served 4 years in the Army, but loved it. I always heard very positive stories about his experience as a military police officer. And so I thought he'd be supportive, but he wasn't. And so he didn't want me to join, not because he didn't like the military, but he really wanted me to go to college. And so I'm a first generation college graduate in my family, so it was important for him. So I didn't join. Finally completed my undergraduate degree, and then really became much more interested in defense when I moved to Germany after I completed my undergraduate studies. I went for 3 months on a work exchange program to improve my German and ended up staying for 4 years because I never have a strategic plan in life. I just do what seems interesting. And I ended up working at that time, which is a long time ago, actually during the Cold War when there was a wall around Berlin. I actually could work legally as an American citizen for the German government, but they seconded me out to U.S. military units. So I ended up working for instance, the U.S. military liaison mission that sent military members over to the Soviet zones. And of course, the Soviet soldiers could come into the Western zones to collect intelligence. And then I worked for the Joint Allied Refugee Operations Center, JROC, that used to screen Eastern Bloc refugees for NATO. So I spent a lot of time working among military members and always enjoyed it. So over the last, I don't know, 30 some, almost 40 years, I've worked for a variety of organizations, sometimes civilian, but I really enjoy working with military members from any force around the world.
Thank you. That's fascinating. And the three of us share that commonality that we are civilians working in defense. And the gender advisors and gender focal points that we have been whose action portfolio in the Professional Military Education Service includes advocating for gender and sociocultural considerations. Brenda, can you tell us about your experiences surrounding this at the Naval War College?
Yes, I'd be happy to, but I hope you don't mind if I give a little background, because for me, who has worked on, as I like to say, women, peace, and security before there was that framework, which is really working on gender equality, which is an underlying principle of women, peace, and security. So that concept has been around a really long time. And the fact that the U.S. Department of Defense is now working on women, peace, and security, I would say in a serious way. And so, yes, we do have these positions of gender advisors and gender focal points, but those are really new. And so I'd like to give a little history about the Naval War College.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
I also started working with them informally in, I think it was 2011. I was working in Kandahar, Afghanistan with the 10th Mountain Division of the U.S. Army on stability operations. And so we were working with women, Afghan women, in a wide variety of ways within the security context. And so anyway, I found out that on a call through the Defense Department about women, peace, and security, that the U.S. Naval War College, which I had no affiliation with, but that they were working on women, peace, and security. I met the Women, Peace, and Security chair at the War College. I ended up taking leave a few months later, meeting with her personally. She invited me to help her arrange the first annual conference on women, peace, and security. And so that was 2012. So it's been a long time. And back then, we didn't have gender advisors. We didn't have gender focal points.
Yes.
We had a national action plan that was implemented a bit here and there, but it wasn't as, people weren't as committed to it as they are today. And so the Naval War College, I'll just say, I assisted them with their first two annual conferences, served as a presenter, helped them design them, because the woman who served as the chair didn't have any background in women, peace, and security. Over the years, it has evolved. I did not formally join the Naval War College until 2017 as an associate professor working on leadership. And it wasn't until 2020 that I started working on women, peace, and security, I'll say again, with the Naval War College. They no longer had a chair, and so we established a steering committee and a general committee, just to give you some sense of how do you implement women, peace, and security if you don't have gender advisors, if you don't have gender focal points. You find people who have some expertise or a willingness to learn to actually implement. And so that's kind of been the trajectory of the Naval War College. Right now, we do have a new chair of Women, Peace, and Security, and she is hoping that more people at the Naval War College take training from the Defense Department to become certified as gender advisors and gender focal points. But for now, until that happens, we work, like I said, we have a general committee that represents every department and or college that is part of the larger Naval War College. And we have a 3-person steering committee on which I sit. And so all of us together are trying to do the job of what would be considered a gender advisor or a gender focal point by integrating women, peace, and security and all the concepts associated with it into curriculum, into war games, into faculty development activities. So I apologize for the long-winded answer, but there's a history behind those terms of gender advisor and gender focal point and what we're doing today.
No, thank you so much for that history and background, because that really gives us a better idea of how we got here. Because we, in my case, I joined as a gender focal point, but there's so much work that has been done already by individuals like yourself that have been there since the beginning, even before the national action plans and the U.S. strategy or the Women, Peace, and Security Act. Now, Vanessa, do you think you follow a similar process at the Canadian Forces College?
We absolutely do. And I think as Brenda mentions, this is new terrain. It's exciting terrain, and it provides us many opportunities to critically think about the way in which we've been doing things without thinking about them through a gender perspective. So in the Canadian context, we've been using gender perspectives for quite a while. We had our first national action plan for women, peace, and security that came out in 2010. Our second national action plan was between the period of 2017 to 2022, and now we're working on our third. So the language and the areas of interest for it from a Canadian perspective continue to evolve over time. And for the military, this continues to evolve as well. For the military, the institution of gender advisors happened very recently. As Brenda suggests, in our context, we have a Canadian defense order. it basically provides a structure to think about gender perspectives institutionally as well as operationally. And it creates a gender structure through the advancement of gender advisors, as well as gender focal points. Now, the way in which that has been integrated in the military context has been kind of ad hoc. And so my perspective, before I became a professor at Canadian Forces College, I was the first gender advisor for the Canadian Defence Academy. The Canadian Defence Academy is kind of has ownership over the Canadian military colleges, all of them. And so we instituted a gender structure from that first principle of having a gender advisor and then gender focal points. So now we have a gender advisor that works at the headquarters level within Canadian Defence Academy. It's a full-time position, and they're just wonderful. And then we have gender focal points that are stationed all over our Canadian military colleges. And it's up to the Canadian military college to decide how many gender focal points they each have. Some military colleges have elected to have another gender advisor position that's full-time. And some haven't. And the general areas of concern within the Canadian military context is to think about the integration of gender perspectives and also intersectionality. And we'll get to that a bit later, but also intersectionality and the way in which the military operates in policies, in programs, in procedures and actions, both at the institutional, from the institutional domain and as well as the operational domain. So this is something that we've been working really hard to do in kind of a haphazard way, but we're getting momentum and we're getting more capacity building and resources and structures around how do we implement gender perspectives through everything that the military does.
I'd like to add what Vanessa said ad hoc.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
That is exactly what's going on in the US as well, because it is new territory. And as we say, we build the car as we drive it. We are expected now to actually, you know, conduct activities, right, that include a gender perspective and whatever that might be, while each institution and the Department of Defense in the U.S. is massive. I mean, there are all sorts of commands and professional military education institutions and a wide variety of other components. And so as everybody tries to wrap their arms around this incredibly important concept, right, to operationalize it, they'll find their own way. And that's actually a good thing. You know, we don't want to have somebody, I don't know, way up high in DOD tell everybody how to do this. Where every command is a little bit different, right? Every area of operations is a little bit different. Every organization has its own mandate or mission. And so in that way, yes, it's a little messy. However, we're going to get there, and that allows us the latitude to decide how to tailor those activities and how to decide who's doing what wherever we happen to be.
Yes, I want to jump in on that because it's something that we've been wrestling with as in Canada, because we have a federal department called Women and Gender Equality. Now, they own the tool that we use to integrate gender perspectives. In the Canadian context, it's called Gender-Based Analysis Plus. The plus is intersectionality. Really, what we're thinking about is how do we properly integrate gender perspectives and thinking about cultural perspectives and intersectionality in our systems, our structures, our processes, as well as our culture. And what's happened is we've had this kind of generic approach across Canadian federal departments to integrate what we call GBA plus, gender-based analysis plus. But in the military context, it's not always easy to recognize how this matters to the military and how the military can then use tools like gender-based analysis plus and gender perspectives in what they do. It's not readily apparent. So there needs to be, as Brenda is saying, a tailoring of gender perspectives to what it is that the military actually does on a day-to-day basis in people's lived experiences institutionally, but also to what they do on the ground operationally. And I think that tailored approach is vitally important, because it creates that turn in terms of thinking about the way in which we create structures, systems, and culture in a very patriarchal way. And we'll get to patriarchy in a second, but in a very gender unequal way. And how can we do this better? How can we be more inclusive in our policies, in our systems, in our structures, and in the way in which we create norms and values in our institutions?
That's great. And both of you highlight here how you're both trailblazers, because you're both practitioners, have worked in operations, but also are teaching this. At the same time, you're institutionalizing it. And speaking of, so I think that I have shared with you this before, but for the audience, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is a powerful voice for women's rights, too. And I bring her up because she was once a student of defense studies, a civilian in defense studies. And in fact, she graduated with class 37 at the Inter-American Defense College. She then went on to become Latin America's first female defense minister and then the first female president of Chile. And it's also remarkable to me that she also had many firsts in terms of implementing Resolution 1325. And in her first term in office, she was one to enact the first national action plan in the hemisphere, really. And then she went further and came out with the second one before anybody else did. So, you know, we see here how it takes a gender entrepreneur, if you will, to be the one spearheading these ideas and then try and adapt them to their reality, because in the second National Action Plan, it already came with a better description of how to implement it and mainstream WPS throughout the government. Can you tell me a little bit from the operations that have helped you the most in implementing it, WPS, where you're at now at the colleges?
For me, and I think this is just a very human thing, right? If you want people to understand a new concept or operationalize it, as we say that in the military, it has to be relevant, right? This is why the tailoring is, as Vanessa was talking about and I alluded to, you've got to take this framework, the Women, Peace, and Security framework that, like I like to say, it's so big you can drive a bus through it. There's a lot there because we're recognizing two halves of a population, right? Women and men, or those who identify as women or men. And so it's complex and it's massive. And there is really something for everyone if you learn about what gender means and the impact it has on all of our lives. And so with that said, for me, I've spent over 7 years in conflict affected countries working on stability operations. You know, I've worked in Africa and Central Asia and the Middle East and Europe. And I'm, you know, boots on the ground. I'm with operators. I'm with people where this is important. And if you think about why we have a defense department, right, in our countries, why we have militaries, I mean, the purpose is, you know, to consider security and to defend whatever it is you're defending in your country, your people. And so when you're in a conflict-affected country, you know, the military plays a critical role in doing that job, right? Providing security, you know, defending whichever populations against whatever population. And so for me, that is something that any military member, whether they work in combat arms or not, they're all there to support combat arms at the end of the day. And so my work with Women, Peace, and Security in the field, in those conflict-affected countries, with folks in combat arms and otherwise, is to make the point of the relevance of women, peace, and security, to recognize the different roles that women play. Because after I had been working internationally for a couple of decades and finally got home and thought, you know, I'd like to do something a little bit different, I thought, you know, I had to really think about my experiences in all of these different countries and the different circumstances that were similar but different, and what was going on and why so many people couldn't see, in my view, the value of acknowledging women and women's roles in conflict. And so I spent about 6 months. I just kind of cleared the decks and I wrote and I researched and I wrote and I researched. And so I created this piece called Hawks, Doves, and Canaries that talks about women as hawks aggressors, doves as peace builders, and canaries as early warning signs of conflict. What happens, women are often the first ones to be negatively impacted when there is, let's just say, instability. It doesn't even have to reach the level of violent conflict. There just needs to be certain groups vying for power. And we've seen this. We see in Afghanistan with the Taliban taking over again. Most Afghans are negatively impacted by that, I would argue. But the ones that are truly impacted most negatively the most are women and girls, right? They're the canaries in the coal mine when you see what's going on with them. And you see this in other countries as well. And so that piece, talking about the multiple roles that women play, they are involved in all of those things. But a lot of people have never seen them that way. So that one piece, I feel, and I wrote it 8 years ago, still has a lot of traction because people have not, and this is not just military members, but for them, most importantly, right? It's women have been sort of invisible on the battlefield. And for their own benefit, when we see them as aggressors, right? They are taking up weapons, right? They are suicide bombers. They are. And if you don't see them as such, if you actually think they're doing nothing, you've got a real problem tactically. And that can endanger troops. And so we need to be aware of that. And then the peace building is the direction you're going in. So why wouldn't you call on women who are active peace builders to assist you in that regard, to stabilize a country? And again, as you're trying to anticipate, every commander wants an early warning sign of an increase in violence or the start of violence. And if you can see the trends in communities of how women are being treated, that's going to give you a very good indication about impending conflict or an escalation in conflict.
Thank you for that, Brenda. And that really sheds light on gender perspectives and the need for us to have a very broad idea of all these perspectives. And especially what you do is shedding that light and illuminating those perspectives so that the leaders don't have those blind spots everywhere they go. And that's a great takeaway to bring back and say, this is the value in what we do on the ground in operations, and then find a way to teach it here so that the students can then take that with them back home if they're from another place and be like, do we have these blind spots? Are we looking at this through a gender lens? And what does that look like, you know, and come up with maybe those new needs that they didn't know they had so that they can then work on institutionalizing, operationalizing. And this is a great go-to where they can start looking at what you have already done, your challenges that you've overcome, your takeaways, and what you're able to bring to academia now and to the Naval War College. And now, Vanessa, tell us what you've been able to take away from these experiences and that you're taking back with you to the college and elsewhere, NATO and wherever you may go.
Absolutely. I think there's a really important nuance to be made, not only where are the women, what are they doing, but what women. And so within societies, all societies have diversity, and we'll get to the definition of diversity a bit later. But when we talk about, you know, where are inequities happening in society and why is this so important to security? Well, in a peacetime context, and you can debate whether there is such a thing as peace. But when you think about domestic operations, for example, you could say, well, how do gender perspectives factor in domestically in operations? And so a really great story from the Canadian perspective is we had massive flooding in a region in Quebec called Gatineau in 2017. This was the first time where gender-based analysis plus, so gender perspectives and intersectionality, were factored into operational planning. And the very first time where we made specific decisions on who gets what access to care at what time, in what place, and what are their particular needs. And so having a gender perspective said, well, what women are experiencing exacerbated risks in their resources to get out of Gatineau? What women experience risks in the ease in accessing mobility? Do people have their own cars? Are they reliant on public transit? Are people having a larger share of elder and family care responsibilities where they need to take care of family members or community members and also have them leave a situation that puts them at higher risk? What are the gender roles within that region? How are men experiencing vulnerability based on intersecting factors such as racialization, ability, age? And so when we think about these factors, we're able to tailor the response in crisis to effectively create secure situations for Canadians and domestically. And so I think this is a really good example because prior to, we may not have thought about the nuances of who needs this type of care at what time and in what place. So really, it's assessing urgency. But I think importantly, it brings up a question about what is the military's role in creating equitable societies so that they are resilient when it comes to crisis and conflict. Because more equitable societies create more resilient societies who are more resilient in the face of crisis and conflict. And, you know, you can see COVID-19 as a perfect example that, you know, really exposed the inequities that exist in our societies, not only on the basis of gender and sex, but also on other bases that intersect, such as ability, such as racialization, indigeneity, and the list goes on. So I think this is really important to think not only of gender perspectives applying operationally out there, but also right here at home. And I think that's something that I like to take into the classroom because people are thinking, okay, well, how am I affected by this? You know, how does my positionality, my gender, my racialization, my ability situate me in a particular position of risk? And just at that very basic kind of level of understanding about yourself, you've already created kind of this intersectional analysis of conflict and crisis based on your own experience. But that multiplies when you start looking at diversity as a factor in operational analysis and planning.
Yes, thank you for that. I mean, there's really so much to unpack, and you have both given us such a great overview of very interesting questions that we're left with, really, because you brought it home, Vanessa, and speaking to even COVID and how all of that needs to be taken into consideration, all these questions that maybe people are not asking themselves, and we need to put that on the table and put it to the leaders also to start with those questions. This was part one of our introductory episode. Thank you to our listeners for staying tuned until the end. In part two, our bonus episode, we'll hear our experts unpack taboo terms that often come up in class and in the world around us. Until then, please remember to subscribe to our show from your favorite platform, and we'd appreciate it if you share it as well. Thank you for listening to this episode. We hope that you will subscribe and tune in as we share more insights and explore women, peace, and security from various theoretical and practical perspectives. This podcast is a production of the Inter-American Defense College. The hosts, guests, and IADC team receive no financial benefits for their participation. The ideas and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the participants alone and should not be taken to express the views of the institutions or governments they represent. To learn more about the IADC and our Women, Peace, and Security program, please go to our show notes for links and resources. You can also visit us at iadc.edu.